This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I have a bunch of questions and I think we can't answer them all, but we try. So I start right now with the first question directed to Larry. So the question is, could you explain how you determined the locks were shaped?
Sorry, how do we determine?
How you determined the locks were shaped?
Oh, that the locks were shaped. Yeah. That's a fundamental point in trying to make the case of human intervention and intention, is to say that the logs are not naturally formed in this way. And that's where we look at the environment in which logs are trapped today and what happens to them in rivers. We also look at how people who are still crafts, artisans with wood in the region, are working and what kind of traces they leave with different kinds of tools. And then we replicate woodworking tools with stone tools that are also used for working. And we try them using the materials in the case of Colombo Falls that are local. We use those same rocks. And then we compare our reference collection with the archaeological materials and embellished by this indigenous knowledge, the artisanal knowledge, and we can see that the shaping, it cannot have happened in any other way than by intentional action by humans. We start cautious and critical and saying, let's rule out alternative sources. And once we have, we're left with humans.
Okay, thank you. So maybe start the next round. A question to Michael. Somebody wrote, I'm wondering whether cognitive capabilities specific to language are easily transferable to construction without biological evolution.
Well, what I was trying to establish was the idea that so far we haven't been able to get chimpanzees, for example, to become creators of stories or to design novel buildings. They have limited forms of communication. They have simple tool use, but with no cumulative development of their tools. And so the idea is there must be something that distinguishes us. Now, on the body front, there's bipedalism, so perhaps that allows us to make better use of our hands because they're not as involved in locomotion. And we can come up with another set of physical changes. But we believe that the crucial changes are in the brain. And so we've tried to look at what parts of the anatomy and physiology of non-human primate brains are preserved and what have changed. So flexible vocal control is one of the obvious things that's relevant to the spoken element of language. The enlargement of the frontal cortex allows a greater range of planning, perhaps. And so then the story was, okay, these evolved. How did these changes evolve? What were the adaptive pressures then? And then the suggestion is, as we've looked at examples from Larry and others, many of these changes took place hundreds of thousands or 100,000 years ago. And so therefore there must be this complementary process where humans had enough construction ability in place to go cumulative. And so the process of cultural evolution could yield more and more subtle physical and symbolic structures.
Okay, thank you very much. The next question is directed to Sue. The conclusion of experiment one is that zebra finches do not build nests by instinct, but could this be falsified if we assume instinct represents a mental module that cannot modify outputs in response to environmental inputs?
I think my response to that is that no behavior is entirely instinctual or entirely learned. And I don't think nest building is different from that. I think there will be instinctual components to nest building, and it's just that I'm not working on those. Currently, we know almost nothing about nest building. So my answer to the question is nebulous and unhelpful to the person who asked it. But if they'd like to do some work on nest building, there's plenty of space.
Yeah, very complex process. Okay, a question to Paul. How much does recent Aboriginal social organization resemble the fully fledged fractal organization described in the talk? And also a second question, is there meaning to the erasure of the rain emblems discussed?
Well, cultural change is constant and ongoing everywhere. And there's been a lot of transformation of cultural systems and beliefs, particularly on the East Coast and in metropolitan areas and regional towns. The most closely resembling part of Australia would be the interior parts, particularly the Northern Territory and Western Australia and some of North Queensland. But even that's under a lot of pressure of change. So in my lifetime, yeah, I've seen that change happening. And there's probably only two or three, three or four actively initiating communities that I could point to, initiating men into higher levels of law, which is an index of that. Second part also, is there meaning to the erasure of the rain emblems discussed? Yes, well, they're sacred designs and they're not meant to be shown widely, which is why I've privileged the 45 people out there today. And they're meant to be, it's this, so this sort of memory bank, the memory knowledge, they're like the songs. There's an oral tradition in the history and a memory tradition, oral and memory traditions in the culture, so that the designs have to be memorised and only reproduced briefly as demonstrations to younger people who are being taught in the process, and then erased. And the production often involves the clearing of the ground and the use of human blood as an adhesive, and then the use of finely chopped up grass down, sometimes feather down, mixed with ochre to make little balls so big, and then those balls are stuck on the blood to make the design. So there's a lot of energy and effort put into the design production, and then the total erasure of that at the end, ready for the next performance, whenever that might be. So that's the answer.
Okay, thank you. Maybe one more question to Larry again. Do you know how durable hafted stone axes are? And have you found any stone tool quarries near the Colombo Fall site?
So how do I know how durable these stone axes are, and have we found any quarries near the Colombo Fall site? This question, in a way, follows on from the previous one. How do we know that the wood has been intentionally modified? And it's a sort of similar answer. It's through experimental archaeology, which is our way of addressing problems where we have nobody to talk to, unlike Paul's case, as he asks questions. You have a cultural answer. So we have to generate our own answers. One of my PhD students built his PhD around hafting these axes into wooden handles and basically beating the hell out of things such as wood and other materials to see what the damage would be. Yeah. And also what damage would be left by the handle on the stone, so that archaeologists can have some level of certainty saying, yeah, we may not have a handle, but we know that this damage, by all likelihood, came from the tool being hafted and being used in a heavy way. So that's experimental archaeology, and it's a very important way of addressing questions in a systematic way, which you build your own reference collection, but the reference collection has to be very good in terms of being broadly applied. You don't go seeking an answer you already think you have in your mind. You have to create uses which are unlikely to have happened, but that they have to be there to really give you a sense of security. Now, the question of the quarry. That word always conjures in my mind that it's kind of a rock face, some big vehicles, you know, packed with stuff and putting up dust. In the case of Calambo Falls, the main source of material we identified just upstream, just about a mile away. And it's boulders, big boulders of the all the raw materials, the quartzites. And the way we can know that that was selected is that we can actually see the initial forms of some of the artifacts we're finding in the site. They're called rough outs. And we can see the stages of testing and then shaping. And then these rough outs are taken back to the archaeological site and were finished there. So they didn't have to go very far. And these early communities were, in a sense, tethered or tied to the distribution of rock materials that they could use because they made big tools. And that's one of the major changes in the archaeological record with hafting. You could use very small pieces to do some of the very same activities and make something lightweight and go long distances and explore new habitats in response to climate change.
So for Christine, I enjoyed seeing some of your images. I'm not quite sure how they feel about the other ones. But as they seem to have been photographed by yourself, how do you navigate your role as an outside observer as well as researcher in spaces of lower income populations?
It's a great question.
Very
hard question. I wrote a preface to my dissertation about this topic, and one of the things that I noticed is that it's just important to recognize, to claim that I am different and I have the option to leave. I always have the option to leave these places. But since that time, since I started researching favelas in Brazil, I've also made a commitment to just continue returning. I studied under a sociologist in Sao Paulo for my Fulbright, and that was her single advice, was to just continue to return and begin to respond to issues and interests of the communities that I engage, even if I don't have a project myself. So one example, I finished my doctoral dissertation, and it was about the spaces. It was an ethnographic accounting of the spaces that, educational spaces that people build or out of housing stock. So it's this transitional processes that I was very interested in. And two young women from the favela flew up to Austin for my defense, and they stood up at the end and they said, we love this project, and we love seeing basically what our parents have built for us over time. But we want to build something that we can do something with to change our community in the future. And that inspired the Xapa Civic Data Lab and the NSF project about situated data. And I chose situated because of, building on Donna Haraway's work, right? So Haraway is famously said something about how situated lens, in contrast to the God view, is one that it's a lens onto things for which you can take responsibility for. And so that's always tends to be in the micro situation. And so the way I navigate my positionality as someone who has the option to leave impoverished places, is to try and do projects only for which I can take responsibility for. I don't tend to do large quantitative studies for that reason. I do field-based studies, and I return, and that's how I navigate it. That's helpful.
Thank you. So the next is to Ricarda. You showed us at the beginning these pillars with symbols on them, but you didn't tell us what your current interpretation is of the role of the symbolism in those T-pillar societies.
Okay, this is a really hard question. The short answer would be there is no interpretation and there can't be an interpretation. Of course, there are many interpretations. So my interpretation, or maybe for the background, so as I told you, I think that our interpretation builds on our perception. And I try to figure out what is our perception today, how do we perceive landscape, or how do we perceive these buildings, and how can we figure out which other interpretations or which other modes of perception would be possible. And my interpretation would be that we heard that the humans are not, or were not every time in the center, and I would also say at Göbekli Tepe, the humans were not in the center, but it was a really, so animals and plant, the nature was at the same stage like the humans, and I would say these buildings were just buildings for like the non-human persons. It's a really big concept, and maybe too, we have not the time to go in it, but I would say the houses were not temples, but houses, like the domestic houses. They were just, usual buildings.
Okay, thank you. Mike, a question to you is, when you look at the way cities have exerted selection on human psychology, do you think that carries over into genetic selection as well?
I don't think I'm qualified to answer that. My inclination is to say no.
And what would you see then as the key changes in human psychology, even if they don't have a biological selective effect?
Again, I don't know too much about that. I mean, one issue is the sort of cognitive limits. And at one point, I wanted to investigate the size of neighborhoods and relate it to Dunbar's number and to see if, why do people live in neighborhoods? Why are neighborhoods exist in every city? And it may be something to do with the cognitive capacity, but I found there wasn't enough data to do that systematically and rigorously.
Okay. Thank you. And the ultimate question is back to Christine. So this person, again, likes your images, but was reminded about ancient cities, like some of those we saw in the earlier slides. And can your understanding of how favelas develop help interpret the development of ancient cities? This is clearly a joint paper by you and Mike that's in the making.
We don't know about that yet.
You say something else.
That sounds great. Can you understand the development of ancient cities through favelas? And I think, most favelas initiated around a water source, they initiated on high ground, so you tend to see patterns of building consolidation on higher grounds, on the best sites, and those areas of risk that are removed within upgrading projects or on the lowest site, they're flooded. And so I think to that extent, I mean, there's a direct relationship between the way cities, ancient cities, have built on high grounds to protect themselves from climate, from all kinds of threats. So I do think that you can study favelas. I mean, I think you can study favelas to understand ancient settlement patterns.
And your point about agency is important.
Mm-hmm. Mike, do you want to add to that?
Well, I agree very much with your last statement. About over 10 years ago, I had a bunch of students. We gathered a bunch of data on informal settlements, and we published a little bit of it. And I always felt that there's a lot more here that will help us understand ancient cities, but I didn't quite see the hook. I didn't quite see how to do it, and I didn't worry about it till I got an email from Kim Dovey, who's a planner in Melbourne and has written on cities and density and quite a bit on informal settlement. And he had an idea that that informal settlement is the original form of urbanism. Actually, this is something I took out of my talk in order to be 18 minutes. I was going to talk about this. anyway, he thinks it was the original form of urbanism, and I agree with him. And we actually were working on a number of things. His first paper on this is now in press. We're working on a paper about Mohenjo-Daro together, and we're probably going to write a few more papers. So I think they have a lot to teach us, and it was really my interactions with him that sort of, I thought, brought it to a point where we can do something useful to this. And one more quick point is that it also shows how interdisciplinary work is difficult. We basically chatted back and forth for a year before we felt we could be able to talk to one another and do anything. And now we're at the point of writing some papers.
I think another point that's really important is that not all density is equal, right? I mean, we think about settlement patterns, and they densify, and you see these very dramatic maps of settlement change. But the rental movement has shown that there's just a gradient of conditions in the density that is actually built, and some of it is quite interesting and what we could call just. It's compact. It could be considered green and adaptive reuse. But at the other end of the spectrum, it's not density that we should promote as a viable settlement pattern. And so it comes back to this idea of land ownership, land reform, and those are questions that I think we really have to get on the ground to understand how tenure is experienced by people who live there versus just looking at the settlement patterns as a neutral agent of change. Again, back to the agency question.
The time has come, on behalf of my fellow speakers, to thank the audience for your attention and interest in this production, and to invite you as the audience to show one last time your appreciation for my distinguished colleagues.
I'd like to thank our two excellent co-chairs and all the speakers for these fantastic talks, and of course you, the audience here, and the audience online. And if you liked what you saw today, you can support us yet again. I am asking for support. We want to continue this. And I promise we have some very interesting topics coming up. On Valentine's Day next year, we will have a symposium on the origin of love, focusing especially on attachment and nurturing. And after that, we have one on mismatch, human origins and modern disease. And next fall, the next one we will have in person will be one on ancient DNA. 10 years in, what are the new revelations? So I look forward to seeing you at future symposia, virtually or in person. Thank you all very, very much. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.